A second wave of COVID sweeps the world and the United States. The president says herd immunity is the answer. The fight with religious communities in New York State and protesters organized for the election. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, October 15th, 2020. Wisconsin and other states in the United States Midwest are battling a surge in COVID-19 cases. New infections and hospitalizations are rising to record levels and a sign of a nationwide second wave as winter arrives. More than 22,000 new cases were reported on Wednesday across the Midwest, surpassing October 9th's record of more than 20,000 cases. A field hospital opened in a Milwaukee suburb as more than 86% of the beds in Wisconsin's intensive care units were filled. Other Midwestern states are also setting grim records. Since the start of October, North Dakota and South Dakota lead the world in reported new COVID-19 cases per capita, three times as many new cases than the United Kingdom, Spain, or France. The director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, explained the outbreak on Good Morning America earlier today.
Baseline of daily infections at approximately 45,000-50,000 per day. And then if you look at the states that you just mentioned, several of them, in well over 30, have upticks in test positivity, which has proven in the past to be a very good prediction of a surge in cases, which ultimately leads to a surge in hospitalizations, and then ultimately in some individuals that will obviously be an increase in deaths. The issue is that as we enter, as we are now, in the cooler season of the fall and ultimately the colder season of the winter, you don't want to be in that compromised position where your baseline daily infection is high and you are increasing as opposed to going in the other direction. So we've really got to double down on the fundamental public health measures that we talk about every single day because they can make a difference.
And that's Dr. Anthony Fauci. President Trump's relationship with Fauci has grown more strained as the president claims the disease is no longer a threat to the country, even as cases skyrocket. Speaking to his supporters, Trump knocked Fauci for playing down the use of face masks in the early days of the pandemic.
And look at all the masks. You know, they keep saying nobody wears masks, wear the masks. Although then they come out with things today. Did you see CDC? That 85% of the people wearing the mask catch it, okay? And yeah, my friend, and he's a nice guy, Tony Fauci. He's a nice guy. He said, this is not a threat. This is not a problem. Don't worry about this. Not that one's a problem. It's the craziest thing. Then he said, do not wear a mask. Do not wear a mask under any circumstances. Don't wear a mask. Don't, right? So we don't wear a mask. Then they say, oh, wear a mask. I never saw, do you ever see any conflicts? But he's a nice guy, so I keep him around, right? We'll keep him around. He's a Democrat. Everybody knows that. He's Cuomo's friend. Cuomo did the worst job of any governor in the United States.
Fauci responded that masks and social distancing are the current best practice for preventing the spread of the disease.
I don't like to be pitted against what the president says, but it's so clear that when you have congregate settings and so many people, when you're in a situation when the community infection rate is there, you can't run away from or argue with the numbers. When you have a high community spread and you're in a situation where we know you can get spread, acquisition and transmission, particularly when people are not wearing masks, is not a good thing. That's a high risk endeavor.
Meanwhile, Trump, apparently recovered from his own bout with the coronavirus, has returned to pushing the notion that America should fight the pandemic by attempting to achieve so-called herd immunity rather than trying to stop the spread through the use of masks and by reducing in-person contacts. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom, said earlier this week that herd immunity is fraught with danger and is unethical.
Herd immunity is achieved by protecting people from a virus, not by exposing them to it. Never in the history of public health has herd immunity been used as a strategy for responding to an outbreak, let alone a pandemic. It's scientifically and ethically problematic. First, we don't know enough about immunity to COVID-19. Most people who are infected with the virus that causes COVID-19 develop an immune response within the first few weeks. But we don't know how strong or lasting that immune response is, or how it differs for different people. We have some clues, but we don't have the complete picture. There have also been some examples of people infected with COVID-19 being infected for a second time. Second, the vast majority of people in most countries remain susceptible to this virus. Seroprevalence surveys suggest that in most countries, less than 10% of the population have been infected with the COVID-19 virus. Letting the virus circulate unchecked therefore means allowing unnecessary infections, suffering, and death. And although older people and those with underlying conditions are most at risk of severe disease and death, they're not the only ones at risk. People of all ages have died. Third, we're only beginning to understand the long-term health impacts among people with COVID-19. I have met with patient groups suffering with what is now being described as long COVID to understand their suffering and needs so we can advance research and rehabilitation. Allowing a dangerous virus that we don't fully understand to run free is simply unethical. It's not an option. But we do have many options. There are many things that countries can do and are doing to control transmission and save lives. It's not a choice between letting the virus run free and shutting down our societies. This virus transmits mainly between close contacts and cause outbreaks that can be controlled by implementing target measures. Prevent amplifying events, protect the vulnerable, empower, educate, and engage communities, and persist with the same tools that we have been advocating since day one. Find, isolate, test, and care for cases, and trace and quarantine their contacts.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom is Director General of the World Health Organization. The number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 is a little less than 8 million. The actual numbers believed to be considerably higher, but 85 to 90% of Americans are still susceptible to catching the disease. There have been more than 216,000 confirmed deaths from COVID-19 in the United States, implying a fatality rate as high as 2.74%. But even at a much lower rate, it could result in a staggering death toll. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo says state funds will be withheld from local governments and schools that do not enforce red zone COVID-19 orders. Cuomo specifically called out Rockland and Orange counties, the village of Spring Valley, Palm Tree, and the town of Ramapo. Cuomo says state money will be withheld from those areas if the enforcement of public health laws continues to be an issue as COVID-19 cases rise. The governor says we could impound all funds. He would rather local enforcement enforce the rules. He said, I guarantee a yeshiva gets closed down and they lose funding, you will see compliance. Yeshivas in Orange County's red zone were seemingly still open Wednesday, despite stepped up enforcement action there this week. A leader in the Orthodox Jewish community, Dov Hykind, lashed out at the governor, accusing him of an obsession with Jewish people.
Governor Cuomo, or King Cuomo, is threatening Jewish groups in different neighborhoods that he's going to cut their funding. What does that mean? He's going to cut funding for seniors, for poor people? He's going to indulge in collective punishment because he's unhappy with the way people are reacting to him? The governor needs to stop being obsessed with Jews. The governor is causing the virus of anti-Semitism to spread all over the country. Governor Cuomo, stop your behavior. You are a progressive. You are a liberal. You wouldn't treat any other group this way. You wouldn't talk about the black community in this fashion, the Asian community, or the Catholic community, or anyone else. But the Jews, it is okay. It is okay to attack the Jews and cause hate. There have been physical assaults in the past week, attacks upon Jews all over, that Jews have the virus. I mean, Cuomo says Jews have the virus. Stop your obsession with the Jewish community. People need to wear masks. People need to do social distancing. That's not the issue. But you are obsessed.
And that's conservative Jewish leader Dov Hykind. Meanwhile, Mayor Bill de Blasio, who has had his own difficulties enforcing mask wearing and limitations in crowds at houses of worship in Crown Heights and other neighborhoods, says he loves the Jewish community and hopes the city can work together.
I want to just talk about what we should be focused on, James. This is a community that I know well and I care deeply for. I have a lot of love for this community, and I always have. And I'm working with my team, with so many members of the community who are trying to address this problem. They're not trying to politicize it. They're not trying to create, you know, tension and division. They're actually trying to address the problem together. And I can certainly say all my colleagues, Dr. Katz, Dr. Chatzy, have been on so many calls, so many constant efforts to work with the community. And we see so many community leaders coming forward, so many community institutions coming forward to address these problems together. That's what we should be focused on. This danger of the second wave, it would affect all of us. It's not about one community or another. But no, come on. We are facing a threat. Let's address the threat together and overcome it. And then we can be proud as New Yorkers that once again we fought back the coronavirus.
Mayor Bill de Blasio. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. With an election less than 3 weeks away and polls showing President Trump in a worse situation than 4 years ago when he managed to squeak out an Electoral College win against Hillary Clinton, with Trump claiming that he won't accept the loss this time, protesters are planning for a bitter fight over the what they call the future of democracy. Heather Nyer is an activist with the group Shut Down DC, a Washington-based organization preparing a response to what they call Protect Democracy.
We were formed in response to the Youth Climate Strikers call for action in September of 2019. We've organized around everything from the climate strikes to standing outside of banks and insurance companies demanding that they recognize the climate crisis. We've been really lucky to work with Black Lives Matter and the Palm Collective this summer, as well as coming outside the Postmaster General's house with our friends at Long Live Go-Go to demand that mail-in ballots and that aspect of democracy be protected.
What do you expect as far as the election?
The only thing that we can really be sure to expect is that Trump is not going to go down without a fight. And whether that's a fair fight or not, we're ready for it. We've already seen things like ballot drop-off boxes being moved. We've seen ads that are misleading and aggressive. We've seen people promising to go as far as to show up at polling stations to intimidate people that may be voting against Trump. And we think we're ready for it, but we do know that it's important to get organized ahead of time so that we're not surprised in November.
What do you mean by ready for it? How do you define that?
So we're having an open organizing call every Thursday night. We're coming up with plans. We're participating in direct action training, so we talk about how to stay safe in the streets, how to make decisions quickly, how to organize with people that care about the same things as you. We're preparing both research aspects as well as in our working groups infrastructure so that when things start happening, we can be ready.
What are your goals? Of the protests?
Our goals, simply to defend democracy. We realize that Trump isn't responsible for all the problems and inequity that we see in this country, and that they're not going to go away, you know, as soon as we vote him out of office. But we also recognize that nothing is going to get better while he's still in office. So that's what we're working on. We want to make sure that everybody who can vote has the right to get their vote counted. We want to make sure that even those who cannot vote, their voices are still heard. We want to make sure that everything that happens in November is fair.
What about the day after the election and the following days?
We're not sure what's happening the day after the election and the following days. Obviously, there could be a Biden win and a landslide, you know, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, everything. And that would change. Then we're probably going to pivot to making sure that the Biden administration takes care of everyone here in this country. If we have Trump declaring victory before all of the mail-in votes are counted, we're going to stand against that. Election night isn't really a thing anymore. In a season where we're talking about this number of mail-in ballots, this number of different ways that people are going to have to vote, it's more of an election season. And we're really invested in making sure that Trump can't claim victory on the 3rd and then go ahead with that.
I see. And just to wrap it up, I mean, the Washington, D.C. police, I've seen them. I was there in 2017, and I saw how they can play pretty rough. What are your plans for that, dealing with that?
We are hosting Staying Safe in the Streets webinars to talk about dealing with everything from chemical weapons to cold weather and dehydration. We're planning to organize using accountable autonomy in our affinity groups. We're planning and we're preparing, but also we do have a right to protest, and we hope that D.C. police is willing to remember that.
And if Trump is reelected, what happens?
More of the same that's been happening for the last 4 years. We've been in this fight for a long time. It didn't start with Trump. It doesn't end with Trump. But we are not going away. We are not backing down. We are going to continue to make sure that everyone's voices are able to be heard and that people in this country, our friends, our family members, ourselves, our rights are protected. We will continue to stand up to Trump and his administration in much the same way that we have for the last 4 years.
Anything like that?
If you're in the D.C. area or just want to get connected with us, you can stay connected by texting democracy to 88202. And if you're not in the D.C. area, we'd love to hear you organize in your own neighborhoods. Anything we can do to help with that, we'd love to.
Heather Nyer is an activist with the group Shutdown D.C., a Washington-based organization preparing a response to protect democracy. As the fourth day of testimony in the nomination hearing of Amy Coney Barrett ended with a date set for a vote next week, an expected easy win for the GOP and President Trump, protesters have been gathering outside the Capitol, both Poe and Kahn. One of the groups that says Barrett's appointment to the court represents an attack on women is Emma Kaplan of Refuse Fascism. She says Trump is an existential threat who must be countered by millions in the streets.
You can only talk about struggling in the streets for so long, you actually have to start it. We should work with people, and we are working with people, but if the only thing that we're doing is counting on some spontaneous uprising after the elections, they're going to be sending out fascist stormtroopers to watch the polls. It's going to get more intense, much, much more intense, the armed thugs that are getting mobilized and getting organized. It's like if you're running a marathon, you know? You have to practice. You have to get your muscles going. You have to be working together, learning together, working as a team, developing the networks, you know? That's why it was important to actually be at the Supreme Court today and to meet a lot of the people who are angered about what's going on. But quite frankly, a lot of people are delusional and think that actually Trump is on his way out and that the only thing that they can do is vote. So it's both sounding the alarm to those people that we do have to get organized, and we're going to unite with everybody to do that. But our best strategy is actually, for example, if you were going to say you were going to do a big protest against police brutality and you just talk about it, you actually had to go out and do it and you had to start.
I don't feel that the problem is between people who are activist oriented and people who are armchair radicals. I think from what I'm hearing, there's a lot of people on the left are getting ready to fight.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need nonviolent sustained protests in the millions. That's our strategy. We don't think that I'm speaking for myself, but you're talking about the most powerful military in the world, the most powerful police in the world. The only thing we can do, the only way we could stop this is to actually overwhelm them with our numbers the way we did in June and July when we sent Trump to his bunker.
How do we do that?
A big part of doing that is, one, in places already, we have started doing these daily occupations, these daily protests in the town squares of different places. And then here in Washington, D.C., we are planning to actually begin these daily protests here as well. And the Women's March this weekend, people should go in New York City, hook up with Refuse Fascism at 10 a.m. Freedom Plaza, the Women's March, where thousands are expected to come. We're going to be organizing people, talking with people, and having a strategizing session on Sunday where people can come make plans together and work together to actually begin this. We don't have all the answers, but we do have a plan and we do have a strategy, and we want people, everybody, to go to work with us on that.
Emma Kaplan of Refuse Fascism. And writer David Rosen says that where there are protesters, there are also provocateurs, police agents and others who may be there to disrupt the protests. Rosen has gathered accounts of dozens of people who were smashing windows and setting fires in the past few months who are actually right-wingers. His article, Protests and Provocateurs, Infiltrators Are Disrupting BLM Protests, is at counterpunch.org.
What I was struck by was the repeated incidences of violence that was occurring, especially destruction of property, private property, that is stores and cars, etc., that was taking place in the light of, or in the, as part of the outrage over the killings that took place and that had continued to take place among the African-American community and black people in this country. Little attention had been paid to the role of what I call provocateurs or infiltrators in this process. And in the course of doing some research to write this article, I was struck by the role of one particular character in Minneapolis who's under the name of Umbrella, the Umbrella Man, who's a kind of right-wing character going around and destroying actually an auto shop windows with a cell phone, who's videotaping with other people watching and asking him what is he doing and why he's doing it. And it's so blatant and extreme, but yet no mass sort of national media took it serious enough to report. And nor did they go in the next step, which is what I tried to do in my article, to look at the role of the infiltrators through the FBI and the local police that have gone on at least since the early 1950s, the modern age, if you will. COINTELPRO was what that was called. And that was, they infiltrated the New Left, the Black Panther Party, all kinds of organizations, leading to many arrests provoked by the state authorities. And that was then, there was something called the Church Committee hearings that took place, which revealed all this. And then it put a temporary stop to it. In the wake of what happened after 9/11, the FBI and other federal agencies, as well as local police, have taken this up again by infiltrating all kinds of groups. If you look at what happened recently in Michigan with the efforts by these right-wing paramilitary groups to apparently kidnap and then kill the governor, Gretchen Whitmer, if you go back and read the FBI's affidavit, which I recommend people to do, you'll find that there were four FBI informers who actually participated in that group and brought the information to the FBI. So what you see here is undercover activities by federal agencies as well as local agents, police, law enforcement, as well as these right-wingers. Because in my article, I detail, based upon public information, that's with all the links so people can actually go and read the articles, how this is spread throughout the country and all kinds of Black Lives Matter demonstrations. These kind of people have appeared, right-wingers or law enforcement agents of one form or another. If anyone of the sort of left who's participating in these actions should be very aware of what's going on, not only with Black Lives Matter, but just going back to the Occupy movement here in New York of what, a decade ago or so, they were participating in that as well, and I document some of them.
Police informants or provocateurs amongst the right wing, ginning them up to do things like kidnap governors and things like that.
In my article, I do discuss a number of efforts by the, during the late 50s, early 60s, of the FBI to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan.
To actually influence.
To provoke actions against civil rights demonstrators.
These militias could actually, they're going around, they're armchair revolutionaries, armchair fascists. You're cowards. You're not men.
Right. Because that's what a real guy who has a certain belief, whether it's the right wing or the left wing belief, will go out and do something and make a revolution, if you will.
To prove something.
Prove something for yourself and for others that they're a stand-up kind of guy. Right. I mean, it has that role, too. I mean, I'm saying these are complex phenomena, which are just, and both in terms of personal relationships and selfhood, you know, and the psychological aspects of it.
And as writer David Rosen, his article, Protests and Provocateurs, Infiltrators Are Disrupting the Black Lives Matter Protests, is at counterpunch.org. David Rosen is a member of WBAI. You can be too. Please give generously. And And that's some of the news for Thursday, October 15th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York City. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.